This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Over the last month, many of us and a great many visitors to Vermont have traversed our back roads to take in what has been an epic fall foliage season. But it wasn't just the colored leaves that had cameras and cell phones clicking. What really makes a great photo is capturing those red, orange, and yellow leaves with one of Vermont's 10,000 barns in the background, the weathered wood, the tumble-down silo, the unique cupolas. One barn that gets a lot of photographic attention is on Route 58 in Irisburg. It's the Robillard Flats Farm, which, to our knowledge, houses the last remaining round barn in operation in the state. I stopped in a few years ago to learn a little bit about the barn from Denise Robillard, who owns the dairy farm with her husband, Bernard.
This is the what you would probably call the basement floor. In the past, it was used as manure storage as the animals were on the second floor. And right now, this is our young calf and heifer facility. They're talking right now because they are hungry. They're all tied towards the middle, facing the middle, and you just walk in front of them and grain them and feed them hay or haylage. All your work is right at your fingertips because you don't walk from one end to the other. You're always where you started.
The Robillards still use the round barn for their calves. Currently, 78 are housed there. Today, we're going to discuss Vermont's barns and the efforts that are going on to save them. Joining us are Devin Coleman, the state's architectural historian, and Thomas Visser, director of UVM's Historic Preservation Program. He's also the author of Field Guide to New England Barns and Farm Buildings. Gentlemen, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Rick.
Now, I've been throwing around a figure of 10,000 barns in the state. Devin Coleman, that's really just an estimate, so how many barns do we know for sure are in Vermont, and how is that number arrived at?
Well, that 10,000 number really came out of it's a rough estimate based on looking at how many barns are we know of and then extrapolating that number statewide. And after a while, that question came up repeatedly, how many are there really? Which led us to start thinking about how we could get an accurate count with the Vermont Barn Census.
Well, why is it so difficult to get an accurate count? These things aren't hopping around. They don't move. They're pretty easy to spot.
That's true. They're hopefully staying in the same place, but they're not always as visible as one might think. If you're out in the countryside with Vermont's rolling hills and mountains, oftentimes a barn may not be visible from the public right-of-way, so you may not know just from driving by what exactly is out in the middle of that farm field, or there could be additional smaller agricultural buildings concealed behind a larger barn. So it's not as easy as it seems.
You mentioned a barn census. When will we have an accurate count? When will that be completed?
Well, the barn census ultimately will be ongoing in perpetuity, because we will, once we get a good baseline count of barns, then we'll keep updating the census so that we can get tracking information on looking over, say, a five-year span. How many barns did we lose in that period? And other barns, as they get older, become eligible as historic resources. So we'll always be adding more barns also. So it's an ongoing project.
Tom Visser, give us an idea of that inventory of 10,000 or so barns and farm buildings. You wrote the book on it. What's out there?
Well, Vermont has an amazing collection of historic barns. And indeed, we have examples that go back to the late 1700s that are scattered around the state. During the sort of boom period of agriculture in the early 1800s, there were many, many examples of barns that were built, especially for dairy farming, that are still with us. And many of them are not still being used for agricultural purposes, and yet they do still have a story to tell. And it is certainly part of that story that makes Vermont something special. And so that's one of our very broad reasons for taking a strong interest in working with the public to help them understand what resources we have and hopefully come up with some preservation strategies.
Well, why are they significant from, say, an architectural or even a historical point of view?
Well, when we compare various types of buildings that we see on the landscape or in our day-to-day travels, of course, you know, we've got houses, we've got commercial buildings, institutional buildings, and so on. And those types of buildings for which there have been specific uses and a good track record of ownership and so on are somewhat easier to document the history on. The issue with the barns is that many of the examples don't conveniently fit into any specific architectural style. They weren't, so say, like a store that may have had a name associated with it. And so because these are what we call vernacular structures, it is a bit more challenging to actually identify them according to some specific category. And I think, you know, as historians, we recognize that they have an important story to tell. And yet it's not the type of story that we can conveniently find in old newspapers or in other written accounts. The evidence is out there on the land.
But you can tell from going into a barn pretty much when it was built because of the type of structure it is or what the methods that were used to build it. Is that right?
Well, this is one of the sort of fascinating areas of this this study, which we're certainly encouraging other people to look for some of these what we call character-defining features. Does it have a hand-hewn timber frame? Does it have sawn rafters? Things like that can tell us a lot about the approximate age of a barn.
We're talking today about Vermont's historic barns and the efforts to save them. Do you own a barn that has been saved? How were you able to do it? Or is it really necessary to save these old structures? You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Devin, I'm going to ask you this first. From an agricultural perspective, most of these are kind of out of date, maybe even useless, despite their striking figure. So why keep them up? Why not just go to hoop houses?
Well, I think there are really two main reasons that come to mind for me. The first, the more obvious, is that barns are part of what Vermont is. They're part of that Vermont brand. And I guarantee if you pick up any state promotional calendar, roadmap, magazine, there's a picture of a barn in that publication. They're part of what people think of when they think of Vermont, that red barn in a green field with the blue sky and the mountains. It's just, it's iconic for this area. On a deeper level, they really connect Vermonters to our heritage, and they're physical reminders in our working landscape of those who came before us and their history of use of the land in Vermont. I think that's really why they're so important, beyond just being photogenic and great to look at. They're tangible elements of our history.
Tom Visser, you make the case now for why we need to keep these. They're useless in a lot of instances. Technology has passed them by. They're big, hulking structures that take up a lot of room. Why keep them?
Well, let's talk about practical reasons to keep old barns. There have been very, very few barns that I've had the pleasure of going into around the state that haven't been used for some rather important function, and that is storage. Many of these structures were constructed to store, hay feed, bulk hay, other things of that sort originally. And yet, due to their large volume, due to their large open interior spaces, often they actually do work well for a lot of today's storage needs. So that's one sort of base level of use for these barns, even if they're not being used for active agricultural purposes.
Now, Devin Coleman, you mentioned that people come to see our barns here. I mean, I could go to Iowa and see barns. I could go to Pennsylvania and see a lot of barns. I mean, why come to Vermont? What's so special about the barns that we have here? And do we really draw a lot of people just coming to see those part of the landscape?
I think they are known. Vermont is known for its rural character and its agricultural history. And part of the barn census, when it was first launched, was funded with a National Park Service grant. So at the national federal level, there was recognition that a project to identify barns in Vermont was worth putting money into and supporting. And I think it is something that we do get calls from people who are visiting. Maybe they come back every year. And if a barn is gone, sometimes they will call us and say, hey, what happened to that barn at the corner of, you know, this intersection? We drive by every year and now it's gone.
Yeah. We do have a note from Leslie Pelch. She's from the Vermont Center for Geographic Information, asks, is it possible to get map data that shows where the historic barns are? Are we there yet?
We're not there yet. That is part of the barn census, is to, once we get a really good data set, to start doing some GIS mapping so that we can identify not just locations of barns, but trends of barn styles, dates of construction, methods of construction, see how that plays out across the state.
Tom Visser, let's move on to kind of rebuilding, repairing, rehabilitating these barns. For someone who has a barn, who wants to go through the process, where do they begin? What's the first step if I'm a barn owner and know that it's in repair? What would I do first?
The first important step is to assess the condition of the barn. And really, this is something that an owner should be doing regularly, at least every spring and fall. This is a great time to take a walk around the old barn. Look at the roof. Check out the walls. Look at the sills. Look for evidence of active deterioration. And I think because these buildings are often, as I mentioned, being used for storage and often quite loved by their owners, and yet there may be budget limitations, obviously, one strategy to help preserve them is to really focus on those needs to stabilize the structure. So again, looking for evidence of active deterioration. Is it a roof leak? Is it a rotten area or whatever? And then put that initial investment, if possible, into slowing down that rate of deterioration, fixing the roof, doing the repair, propping up the a sill or something that may be going on in the basement.
Preservation Trust of Vermont has an assessment program which costs, I think, $500. They'll fund half of it if the owner funds the other half. At what point does the barn owner get past just being able to do their own assessment and need to bring someone in like Preservation Trust?
That program has been enormously helpful in assisting many, many barn owners over the years, mainly in establishing priorities. And I think for many owners, that is the first challenge. You know, where do we begin? We know something has to be done, but what's more important? Should we do this or do that? And so that's where these grants have really been helpful. And the overall goal, of course, is to provide the owners with a roadmap, in essence, that says, here's your first need. Then when that's done, here are the following steps, and continue to check those conditions. Again, once we find that there's momentum underway to do those repairs, it often will continue well into the future.
Now, when they get that assessment, a lot of times they find they have kind of a bigger problem. It's going to take a lot more money, a lot more effort. And Devin Coleman, the state has a barn grant program. So why don't you explain where that comes into the process?
Yes, the state of Vermont legislature has funded a barn grant program since 1992, and I believe it was the first in the nation to put public money towards trying to rehabilitate these agricultural buildings. And it's a matching grant program, so there's an emphasis on the owner making a commitment and investing their own money in the building, and the grant is there to oftentimes bridge the gap between either a somewhat more expensive rehabilitation project versus demolition. And certainly the goal is to keep these barns standing and in use.
And I think we're coming up on a deadline, aren't we, for application?
Yes. The deadline is November 3rd for the 2015 grant round. So if you can get your application in for that. But it is an annual grant program.
How much money generally is available for these grants? How much money has the state paid out over the years?
Typically, it's an annual appropriation, and it's around $200,000. We always get far more requests for funding than we can fund, but the typical grant award is between $10,000 and $15,000.
Let's take a call now from Karen. She's calling from Williston. Karen, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. And what would you like to tell us?
Well, I'm delighted that you're addressing this issue, and I'm calling because about 3 years ago, we had our barn that goes with our homestead restored by a group called Building Heritage, and Elliot Lothrop was the owner, and I think was a student of Dr. Visser's, and some of his workmen as well, and they did a superb job. The barn was ready to fall down. It was leaning about over 30 degrees, and we were thinking of having it knocked down and building a smaller structure, and talked to Elliot, and we made a plan, and they did an absolutely splendid job, and we're just delighted. It's quite near our old house, and we have other outbuildings, so it just it makes us very happy that we decided not to knock it down.
Well, Karen, thanks for sharing that. Tom Visser, do you recall this particular structure?
Well, thank you very much, Karen, for letting us know about the project. And indeed, Elliot was one of our students at the University of Vermont Historic Preservation Program. So we're very, very pleased to hear that it's worked out so well for you.
This is Vermont Edition, and we are talking about historic barns today. You can join the conversation. What do you want to know about the help that's available to barn owners who want to rehabilitate their historic structure? You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. You can post your question on our Facebook page, the Vermont Edition Facebook page. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Today we're getting a picture of the farm buildings in Vermont and the efforts that are going on to save some of these barns. I'm speaking with Tom Visser, director of UVM's Historic Preservation Program, and Devin Coleman, Vermont's state architectural historian. We had this comment from Kristen in Williston. She emailed, "I'm writing on behalf of the Friends of the Brennan Barn. It's a citizen group dedicated to preserving the historic Brennan Barn in Williston. It was built in 1805. It's listed on the State of Vermont's Historic Registry due to its rare architecture. The Friends of Brennan Barn's ultimate goal is to convert the dilapidated barn into a much-needed community center, something the town of Williston does not possess at this time. Any suggestions as to how we might proceed with fundraising and grant writing without the support of village leaders?" Devin Coleman, any recommendations on what Kristen and her group can do?
I think one of the most important things is to get people in the building. And it's one thing to show a picture, but there's something about an old barn, just because it's more than just the building. It's the smells, the ambience of being in the barn. It really gives you a sense of place, of knowing exactly what the building was for. So I think having some sort of community event, a series of gatherings of some sort, public informational meetings on site, getting people in the building, touching it, seeing it, smelling it, that can go a long ways towards building appreciation.
Well, one person who can probably help answer this question as well will join us now. It's former State Senator Matt Dunn. He's a member of the Friends of Lemax Farm. It's a group working to save a barn in North Heartland. Matt Dunn, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me.
For those unfamiliar with the Lemax Farm, tell us about the structures that you're working on right now to repair and save there.
Sure. The Lemax Farm, sometimes known as the Yellow Farm, is a large dairy barn complex, and it is owned by the Meacham family, who are dairy farmers in North Heartland, Vermont, and it sits on 300 acres of conserved property. The land has been put in the Upper Valley Land Trust, so it'll be a farm forever. And the structures themselves are a really interesting representation of farm architecture throughout the last couple of centuries. You've got the big five-story barn that was built in the 1890s by the Miller family. You have attached to it what appears to be a 1790s English threshing barn that was somewhere else on the property, and they rolled over and attached to the barn. And it's a very interesting piece of architecture. It has gunstock oak posts that are really wide at the top, and it's just beautiful. And then you have a horse barn that's now used as a shop, which was built around the same time as the big barn. And then a long 1960s barn that they used to expand their herd and to use more modern practices for manure removal and other kinds of activities. So it's a very prominent complex. It can be seen from Interstate 91, so millions of people see it. And it's also served as the gateway into Heartland from the north on Route 5.
Mm-hmm. Matt, give us an idea of what the rehabilitation would cost and where your group is right now with that.
Yeah, this was a project that was taken on or started a couple of years ago. There's a group at the Heartland Elementary School that wanted to repaint the barn. The barns had fallen into a bit of disrepair and wanted to get out there and paint, and they discovered that, in fact, there were much bigger structural issues before they got into even painting it. We reached out to the Upper Valley Land Trust, and they agreed to be our fiscal agent. We then reached out to the Preservation Trust of Vermont that has a wonderful small $250 grant program to allow us to get a barn expert in to do an assessment. Once that assessment was complete, it was clear that we needed to do a lot of work, and it's probably $165,000 is what we're estimating right now to do all of the barns. There's a wall that is starting to cave in on one side of the big barn. There's the high drive, which is this amazing bridge. You can enter the barn at four different levels, and there's this bridge, and the high drive is starting to collapse, even though it's being used every day. So there's a number of things that have to be done. But the good news is that for $165,000, it'll be ready for another 100 years.
Wow.
The concern is that if we wait even another 5 or 6 years, that number could be 3, 4, 5 times as much to keep those barns around.
And you heard the note I read from Kristen, who's with the Friends of the Brennan Barn, looking for some direction. Any advice to her group and other groups on how to get this done, how to get a community involved to help raise this money?
Well, I think the comment that was made before about just getting people there is a big part of it. We did our outreach starting with setting up a Facebook page and inviting people to tell their stories about the barns, and we found all kinds of people who had, you know, worked at the Lemax farm at different times and or had some connection to it in a real way, and we were able to post photos and historical information, and that sort of started generating the interest. We also used the barn grant deadline as a motivator because there is the required match, which is not small. We made the outreach that said, let's try to raise, you know, $40,000 by October 1st so that we would know that we would have the money on hand to be able to do the project and apply for the grant by November 1. And that helped a lot as well. And then we did a big event at the farm with a silent auction, with barn tours and other kinds of things. And that was a big success, much more than we had expected. Lots of local businesses stepped up to donate goods to the auction itself, and Mascoma Bank was willing to underwrite the event. So that really got people energized and excited about it. We've raised $55,000 to date, so we will be applying for the barn grant. We have, if the barn grant is successful, we'll still have $100,000 to go. So we're applying to other kinds of corporate and independent foundations, hoping that we can make that gap up by February so we can bid out the whole project and do it in one construction season.
Great. Thanks, Matt. Matt Dunn is a member of the Friends of Lemax Farm. Thanks for joining us today.
You bet. And people can find out more at lemaxfarm.com lemax.com, lemaxfarm.com.
All right, and we do have a link to their Facebook page on today's page for Vermont Edition. Devin Coleman, one more thing about Matt Dunn. He actually went through the Barn Grant Program for the state for property, his own property.
Correct. Yep. I think he's received at least one, if not two grants for work on his own barn. So it's great to have that local support.
What a great story. Now, we also received an email from Silas who says, thanks to the Division of Historic Preservation and the Preservation Trust of Vermont, both for matching grant funding, I am able to make a living repairing and restoring historic barns near my home in Stratford. It's important to preserve these barns for many reasons. Most important to me is the insight to traditional building methods. Old barns have a lot to teach us about sustainable and efficient use of materials and the energy and skills used to process them into a useful, not to mention beautiful structure. Tom Visser, who are some of these people who are doing the work to help save these barns, to preserve them? I guess they're joiners, and who are they?
The traditional term for those people who would have constructed the frame would be a joiner or a timber framer. And one of the things that's rather special about many of the older barns is that those construction techniques are so visible. There are no interior walls that are masking the frame. And many times these frames were virtually sculptured by the craftspeople who would have made them 100 or 200 years ago. There was the earlier comment about the 1790s English threshing barn. And this is one of these very special examples that does have the old gunstock corner posts. And it's an amazing amount of craft work that went into producing these structures. And, I mean, to get to the question of who's out there today, one of the sort of delightful things, of course, with this increased awareness about the importance of saving the barns is that it is creating opportunities, particularly for local contractors, to provide their skills to help save our historic resources here. There are many contractors who are able to help in many ways. There are some who are specializing in timber frame repairs, foundation repairs, slate roof repairs, and then there are other general contractors who, of course, are available for the basic maintenance needs, repairing a wall, a window, or door, or whatever.
Devin Coleman, one of the things you stress to give barns that extended life is something called adaptive reuse. So explain that term. Give some examples of that.
So adaptive reuse is just what it sounds like, basically taking an existing building that has maybe outlived its original purpose and adapting it for some sort of new use. It could be, at the most basic level, just storage, as Tom mentioned before. But in driving yesterday around the state from Rutland to Montpelier in anticipation of this show, I looked at what barns am I seeing and how are they being used? And there were, of course, many that were still in agricultural use, used for hay storage, equipment storage. I saw an automobile repair shop. I saw a woodworking studio, a farm stand. It looked like a local food hub of some sort. I even saw a church in an old barn. So there can really be any range of uses for these buildings.
Now, I hate for you to have to pick favorites, but you've both been in hundreds of barns and farm buildings throughout this state, every corner of it. Can you pick out a few favorites that you love and tell us why? Tom Visser, you first.
Well, I think one of my favorites, and I think for many Vermonters, a favorite example of a historic barn or a pair of historic barns in this case are the pair of monitor roof barns along Route 2 and along the interstate highway between in Richmond, roughly between Burlington and Montpelier. I mean, not only are they majestic in their scale, their appearance, and in their design, but they're also examples of incredible local hard work that's gone into saving them.
Yeah. And Devin Coleman, you?
Well, there are some barns that are the real showpieces, like at Shelburne Farms, that are just spectacular. But those really don't represent the average experience of the Vermont farmer. So I'd have to say my favorite barns are just the simple vernacular buildings that you stumble across on a hillside farm that are just so evocative of the agricultural history of our state.
I do want to remind everyone that we do have a link to the barn grant application for the state at our webpage at vpr.net. Devin Coleman is the state's architectural historian, and Thomas Visser is director of UVM's Historic Preservation Program. He's also the author of Field Guide to New England Barns and Farm Buildings. I want to thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And coming up with Election Day just a few days ahead, we'll hear from the three major party candidates for treasurer on where they stand on the top issues facing that office. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Voters may be forgiven for feeling unaware of the issues and candidates in the race for state treasurer. The legislature gets to decide how the state spends its money. But it's the treasurer's job to oversee the funds in the state's bank accounts, and that includes pension funds for public employees. Incumbent Beth Pierce is the nominee of the Democratic Party, but there are two challengers to the left of Pierce who are using their campaigns to highlight how Vermont's financial decisions reflect on the state's political priorities. Don Schramm is the progressive nominee, and Murray Goyma is the Liberty Union candidate. VPR's Patty Daniels has this overview of the three candidates for treasurer.
One of the traditional priorities of the treasurer is the state's bond rating. A high rating means the state can borrow money with the lowest possible interest rate. Beth Pierce is the incumbent.
That's very important to the taxpayers. It reduces the cost of government in terms of our borrowing. It also impacts every single citizen in one way or the other.
Pierce touts Vermont's bond rating as the highest in New England. The state gets a AAA rating from two agencies and a AA plus from a third. She says that makes it less expensive for Vermonters to get certain student loans, mortgages from state-backed lending, and bonds for economic development. And she says strong financial management is what earns a high bond rating.
There are things that are out of our control. There's a world economy that has ups and downs. There are national events that impact the ratings. But what we do have in our control is our fiscal responsibility and managing our finances. And that's something that I take very seriously.
But Liberty Union candidate Murray Goyma argues that the state bond rating isn't that important.
The state bond rating, that becomes a moot point if you're not floating bonds outside the state.
Goyma would rather the state not work with what she calls mega banks.
When we float bonds with those financial institutions, we incur interest costs and administrative fees. Our ability to pay that interest and pay those fees is what gives us our bond rating, because we're good. We're good customers.
She'd rather we be good customers for a public Vermont state bank. And we'll get back to that idea in a moment. But on the question of how important is a good bond rating, here's progressive Don Schramm.
I'm not that knowledgeable about it. My overall sense is that it's overrated. I often hear people say, oh, we got to be concerned about our bond rating, and I don't understand the argument for that.
Managing pension funds for teachers, state and municipal employees is also in the treasurer's portfolio. Those pension funds took a big hit in the Great Recession that began in 2008. Beth Pierce, the Democratic nominee, says she's worked hard to help the state recover those losses since she became treasurer 4 years ago.
In 2010, 2011, we made changes to the state and the teacher system. They're saving the taxpayers about $20 million a year. We made a change to the health care and the teachers. That's having an impact.
Pierce says the teachers' pension fund had been chronically underfunded before the recession, and it won't be fully funded until 2038. Liberty Union candidate Murray Goyma calls pensions a promise that Vermont has to keep with its state employees. But Goyma's priority for the pension funds is getting that money out of certain investments.
The state pension fund does not have to be funded on blood money. We don't have to invest in oil companies and fracking and armaments in order to fund the state pension funds. We just need to allocate the money that we have promised people.
Progressive candidate Don Schramm agrees that pension funds must be divested from fossil fuels. He says that's only 0.2% of the portfolio, and it shouldn't be hard to divest.
we need to tell these corporations that they cannot do this. They must leave 3/4 of their fossil fuel in the ground, period. The most direct way to deliver this message is by divesting from their stocks, giving them less money to drill new wells and strip new mountains.
But Pierce says divestment isn't that simple because the treasurer has a fiduciary responsibility to the 47,000 workers in the pension system.
We've done some analysis, and those analyses indicate between $8.8 and up to $10 million of investment loss per year, not to mention the initial transaction cost to divest from fossil fuels. That cost is something that now puts a dent in our terms of our retirement security.
A similar wedge between Pierce and her two challengers comes on that question of creating a state bank. Pierce is reluctant. Her two opponents support it. Progressive candidate Schramm says all the cash that Vermont now keeps with publicly traded banks should be held in a public state bank instead.
Well, first of all, we would save the $1 million in bank fees. But most importantly, it would mean that we would be taking that $350 million and investing it in Vermont enterprises. And so it would be an economic stimulus to the state.
Goyma, the Liberty Union candidate, says another benefit of a state bank is ending relationships with institutions that she calls morally challenged.
When we're investing outside of the state in these federal or global corporate banks, we're supporting things that I think is ethically wrong.
Incumbent Beth Pierce says interest in creating a state bank comes from anger at Wall Street. And while she shares that, she has reservations about starting a state bank.
It does a couple of things. It adds risk. Our financial advisors believe that it would have a negative impact on our bond rating. There's also an issue of capitalization. Where are you going to get the capital, and how are you going to do that to create a state bank?
All three candidates say the Vermont Economic Development Authority is already doing some of the work that a state bank would do. Each of the candidates also has projects they want to pursue as treasurer. Marie Goyma is an artist and arts educator, and she wants to elevate the concept of a creative economy in Vermont. Don Schramm says he'd support turning Burlington Telecom into a cooperative utility that offers service far beyond Burlington. And Beth Pierce wants to continue her work increasing Vermonters' financial literacy. For VPR News, I'm Patty Daniels.
Don Schramm is the progressive nominee for state treasurer. Marie Goyma is the Liberty Union candidate. And Democrat Beth Pierce is the incumbent state treasurer. At this time of year, seeing two guys stalking around a graveyard conjures up some spooky images. But if you're in Vermont, you may just be seeing Scott Baer and Daniel Barlow. Together, they have found a passion, nay, an obsession for photographing the beauty found in cemeteries. Their work is now on display at the Vermont Historical Society Museum in Montpelier, and they've used their photos to help illuminate different eras in funerary art. Jane Lindholm got a tour of the exhibit from the artists. Starting with gravestones from the 1700s, Scott Baer described their significance.
For the earliest era here, we have memento mori, which is translated from Latin directly as remember that you will die. At this point in history, we had not yet got into Christianity symbols such as crosses and angels. More of it was personalized for how people reflected on what happened to you after you died. One of my favorite pieces comes from East Hill Cemetery in Williamstown. It's dated around 1800. And it's a crudely carved face known as a soul effigy. The face has a almost puzzled look on it, and that's reflective of people's nature at that time to be unsure of where you went when you died. It was not a guarantee that you would go necessarily to heaven or to hell. It was more of an up-in-the-air concept, and it was a hopeful wish and dream of people that they would go where they wanted to go.
What made you want to photograph that particular tombstone?
That one's striking to me just because of the carving. A lot of the stones back then were prior to the granite era. They weren't pulling that stone out of the ground yet, so slate was a very common and reliable product in the state. It held up well over the years for the most part and was easy to carve with. These soul effigies are actually a little on the rarer side because they only occur from 1790 to about 1810.
It is a pretty crude symbol when you look at it. I mean, it looks like something I could draw.
Exactly, yeah. Some of these artists back then maybe were not the renowned Italians coming overseas to do their art. It was more like whoever had the tools, the capability, and wished to do the job and got paid for it. And the art was based on their skill level, obviously.
And when you're taking a photo like this, are you looking for this particular type of symbol, or did you just find it and happen to take a photo and then, great, it gets to be in the exhibit?
Well, when we find an older cemetery, we're usually excited to find things like soul effigies or even coffins carved in the stones, which are an even rarer symbol. We're always hunting for the ever-elusive death's head, which are common in other New England states, mainly the coastal ones that were settled before us. But it was an art style that fell away before our work started being incorporated into gravestones.
So, Dan, you want to take us into the next stage here?
So as you move into the 1800s, the gravestone artwork really softened, and it focused more on the spiritual side of the idea of the soul going to heaven. So you had popular images were like the weeping willows. You see that all throughout Vermont cemeteries from the 1800s. Also a popular symbol is the hand with an index finger pointing up, literally directing the soul to heaven. And this really reflected how Vermonters were viewing life in the afterlife. Actually, I want to talk about two of these right here. So this is the grave of Colonel James Fisk down in Brattleboro. He's quite the character. He was a robber baron, a very shady businessman, married several times, ended up being murdered by a business partner. And his monument in Brattleboro is surrounded by four statues of topless women. And each one is holding a symbol of his empire while he was alive. So you can just tell the ego of this man. It's interesting to contrast Colonel James Fisk's grave with the grave of John Bauman down in Bennington County. His family died tragically very young, and he was just overcome with grief. So he spent much of his fortune building a mausoleum for his family, and there are statues of his family inside the mausoleum, but there's also a life-size statue of him walking up the steps to the mausoleum with a key in hand to go join his family. It's an amazing statue. You can really see the grief on his face, and it's really exemplifies that desire to join his family in the afterlife.
Now, in contrast to what Scott was showing us earlier, the carvings here in the second sort of era that you're talking about, when you moved away from art that depicts death into something that's a little bit more, has more symbolism, more religious symbolism, the artwork is also much improved by the look of it anyway. And so from here, we move into the Barry Granite era, where I imagine it's even better. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, the Barry Granite era was an explosion of talent here in Vermont. Barry Granite is world-renowned. It's easy to work with. It's very weather-resistant. And when we started mining that in Barry, we had an influx of talent coming from overseas, from, you know, Italy, from France, from Finland, from Germany. They all wanted to work with Barry Granite. So you just saw an amazing collection of artists here in the area working on stones that not only, you know, are here in Vermont, but across the country.
So show me one that you really like in this segment. Or section.
Sure. So one of my favorites is right here, Little Margaret. She's buried at Greenmount Cemetery here in Montpelier, just on the outsides of town. This is from the late 1800s. Little Margaret Pitkin was her full name. She died very young. I think she was 8 or 9 years old. And she has a beautiful statue right on the edges of Greenmount Cemetery. And in fact, actually, it's so well known that people come there and they leave pennies as mementos in her cradled arms of the statue.
And this, boy, I mean, her face is so well carved. It's really expressive.
Yeah, I know the carver worked directly off a photo that the family had of the young girl, so you get that the realism there kind of ties into the larger themes of the death of innocence, the death of life.
And then, Scott, you wanted to bring us into the modern era with one of the photographs that you took from a more contemporary gravestone.
Yes, this one's actually very modern. It's from the 2000s. We're not going to give a name or an exact date because we want to respect the living relatives of this individual. But it's from Fairview Cemetery in East Callis, and it's quite simply a Budweiser can carved onto the side of a granite block adjacent to the actual gravestone. And the fun part of this is that not only is it that can symbol, using the brand name and logo and everything, but atop the stone is a carved-out circular hole that's actually a beer cozy. So if you had wanted to go and, you know, pay your last respects to him on any given day, you could have a beer with your old departed friend.
Well, Dan, how do you deal with people saying this is a pretty grim hobby you have, or, you know, sort of something that's a little bit macabre?
You know, I often hear that, and I think sometimes people are like, you hang out in cemeteries? That's really weird, Dan. And, you know, I don't see it that way. I think this is an unsung art form in Vermont that people really need to start recognizing. And the importance of this is that it's asking some big questions. What is the meaning of life? What happens when we die? Is there an afterlife? And these are questions that we don't, as a society, talk to each other very often about. So I think that's part of it as well. I will have to say, you know, the reaction we get from most people is that they have their own favorite cemetery, and they want to tell us about it, and they want us to go there and photograph it. So we often experience that people want to share their own experiences with cemeteries and graveyards with us.
Well, Dan and Scott, thank you very much for showing me the exhibit. I appreciate it, and happy photographing.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having us on.
Thanks, Jane.
Scott Baer and Daniel Barlow are the artists behind the Green Mountain Graveyards exhibit of funerary art at the Vermont Historical Society in Montpelier. We have a link to more information and some of the photographs they described at vpr.net. That's it for today. Tomorrow, we'll have a roundtable discussion with some of the state's top political reporters about the upcoming election. Are there any surprises likely next Tuesday? Email vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Isla Yersel. Peter Biello directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Rick Singeri. Thanks for listening.